Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show. Before we begin, let's hear a quick message from our sponsor.
Do you love doing HR reporting and messy spreadsheets? Or do you get excited about building complicated HR dashboards in Excel? If that's you, then you can stop listening now. But for the rest of the people and HR leaders out there who hate the manual process of logging into all these different HR systems, your ATS, HRIS, performance system, engagement system, downloading spreadsheets, turning that into one massive messy spreadsheet, and then updating that template week after week, month after month, we have a solution for you. And it's called Employee Cycle, the super simple, automated, real-time HR analytics dashboard that simply connects to all of your different HR systems, pulls all of that data that you're constantly viewing and tracking to better understand your workforce, and turns it into a beautiful and organized dashboard. Yes, that's right. You can track all your engagement, turnover, diversity, performance, employer brand reputation data all in the same place. It's all updated, and the best part, no spreadsheets. Hope that made you smile. If you want to learn more about this and this is getting you excited, then you can go to employeecycle.com, sign up for a demo, and guess what? You can even get a 30-day free trial to try before you buy. Boom! What's better than that? Again, employeecycle.com, sign up for a demo, and we look forward to speaking to you soon. Now, enjoy this awesome episode.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host for today, Bruce Marable. And today we have a very special guest who is the Director of Graduate Programs and Human Resources Development at Villanova University. And today we're going to talk about how should colleges prepare HR leaders of tomorrow. So please give it up for Jerry Brandon. Woo! Jerry!
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you so much for coming to the podcast.
Excited to be here.
So this is going to be very similar to when you lecture and speak to your students. The only difference is you're only going to have a student of one. And so I'm going to ask a lot of questions, and you're going to give awesome answers. But before we get into the topic today, can you please let me and the listeners know how you ended up in the wonderful world of HR?
Sure. I have a longer history, so it might not be. I'll keep it focused, but it's a longer story because I've had a career in HR before going into academia. So let me tell you my story. I was a psychology major undergrad, and went on to graduate school and studied industrial organizational psychology. So I got my PhD in IO psychology from Penn State. And the choice that an IO PhD has, broadly speaking, is to go into industry, to go into consulting, or to go into academia. And I chose to go into industry. And I worked at in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, for the Pennsylvania State Education Association, the Teachers Union of Pennsylvania, in the research department. I was there for 9 years, but you know, with this IO background, very strong understanding of employment and workplace behavior and so on. But I applied it to other things in those first 9 years in research. But the current head of HR, then called personnel, was retiring, and I was recruited to go into HR and take over that function, which was a senior level position. And so for 17 years, I served as the HR manager for the Pennsylvania State Education Association, an organization that had at the time 180,000 members across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And we had 260 staff, 13 field office locations headquartered in Harrisburg. And my job was to oversee all of the HR functions. Had a very good benefits package there that had me qualifying for a pension benefit at a relatively young age. And I considered at that point going to do something with the balance of my career, which brought me to consider academia. And I taught for 2 years in the Organization and Management Studies Department at Gettysburg College. And then about 3 years ago, there was an advertised opening here at Villanova University. They were having their first leadership transition for the graduate programs in HR here. They were looking for an IO psychologist, somebody who had background, actually real world applied experience as an HR professional, and someone who knew about higher ed. So I was checking all the boxes, and that's how I ended up. I'm answering your question more than how did I get into HR, but giving you a little bit about how I got here in Villanova. So the direction was from IO psychology, which is not typical into HR, but it was an interesting place to apply IO concepts. And it's relevant for the work that we do here at Villanova and probably some of the other things we're going to talk about today.
And could you give us a little background about your role in the department at Villanova and tell us a little bit about the department?
Sure. My role is as director of the graduate programs. We have about 350 students total, split between the online version and our campus version, heavily dominated by the online. That was not true originally because the online's relatively new. The campus program started in 1980. The online started about 8 years ago in 2010. But we have about 300 students in the online program and 50 students on campus. My appointment is in the Department of Psychology as an associate professor. So I have teaching responsibilities and director administrative responsibilities for the program. Our staff, we have a mixture of roles here. We have two other IO psychologists who are on the faculty who teach in the HRD program here, and they conduct research, some really interesting research that they have going on diversity and inclusion, culture, toxic leadership. So we like to promote what they're doing and their investigations. We also have staff who teach in the program who are on staff, who are credentialed in HR. And we have a lot of adjunct faculty who work in the program. And oftentimes you hear, this is a, university that relies on adjuncts. And, that might be viewed as a negative. For our program, we see that as a positive because we're bringing people in who are credentialed, but who also have experience working out in the field, in the real world, doing their craft, their professional discipline. So we have lawyers teaching our employment law class, and they can bring that experience into the classroom. We have people working for benefits organizations who teach our compensation and benefits programs or who specialized in HR technology and so on. So that gives you a little flavor of the structure of the program, who's here, and a little bit about the program as well.
So our topic today is how should college prepare HR leaders of tomorrow? So let's really dig into the foundation of preparing these leaders of tomorrow with the actual curriculum that they're being taught. So what does the current curriculum for an HR graduate student look like? And let's break that down from the required classes versus the electives or the other different tracks that they can take, if that's even an option.
Yes, that's a great question. And it was a question I had as I came into the role of director. I was fortunate to assume the role of director of a very successful program, been in existence for, at the time, 35 years. The campus program had been here for 35 years. And one of the things that I decided to do was to engage all of our staff in what we ended up calling a strategic review. It was basically strategic planning, but applied to our program, and asking the question, what is it that HR students, professionals who are students, need to know to go into the HR field today? And also, where is the field going, so that we could be prepared to make adjustments to our program for the present as well as the future. And we did the typical things you do in a strategic planning. We looked at the profession. We looked at higher education. That's the industry we're in. We looked at where is technology and communications going? What are other programs doing? What do our customers, the students, you know, what are they looking for? How are their lives structured that we can be adaptable to make what we're doing more readily available to them? So we looked at SHRM, we looked at the professional bodies of knowledge that the associations had put out there, and we're a generalist program. So we decided that's our brand, and that's probably where we're most successful. So we have a set of required classes in the program, but we also have some electives. We have two. If you're coming in with no experience to our program, we have a Introduction to HR in the Business World class that's required and is a prerequisite for all of the rest of our classes. We want to give our students the terminology and vocabulary and an understanding of where HR fits, maybe even some business concepts. So you can come into the program and, you know, transitioning into HR if that's what you're looking at. We have a second prerequisite that is intended to prepare the students for graduate work, but also helpful in their career, called critical evaluation and research writing. Now, those can be waived if you come in with experience or you come in with a strong research and writing background. And then the sort of the meat of the program, the required classes, a very broad class called Foundations of Strategic HR. We have a class on employment law, training and development, strategic workforce management, financial and human capital, organization development, and HR analytics. So that's where the requirements are. And then we have a number of electives, including compensation and benefits. Those are separate classes. We have HR technology and some other classes that we rotate through. Organization behavior is another elective that's available. Diversity in a global economy. So you're hearing a lot of words: strategic, global, diversity, and you know, those were things that were important to us about the program and also where the profession's going.
Interesting. And you said that depending on if the student actually had experience or is working in the field, then they may have to take different classes, or they may be a little bit more further along than others. So I'm curious, are a lot of students that are going into the graduate program actually going straight from undergrad, or are they actually working in the field and then going to further their professional development in the space?
So here's the history. That's a great question. And there's a difference between our campus students and our online students. And there's also, I think we hope, a difference between maybe the past and the future, because we're making some changes that is intended to reach out and help people who are in transition. The online program previously had a requirement that you had to have 3 years of experience in order to be eligible to be an applicant for the position and get admitted to the program. And we heard about a lot of people who didn't have the 3 years, but they really wanted HR. And that's why we built this bridge in, which is this intro class and critical evaluation of research writing. So predominantly the online was composed of people who were doing HR and have been doing it for at least 3 years. And we expect that with this bridge, we're going to see more people transitioning, coming in with no experience who want to do HR. At the same time, we want to keep the space for the HR professionals. Now, our campus program historically had about a third of the students coming directly from undergrad, deciding that they wanted to get their master's degree and you know, pursue a career in HR. But we also had a lot of early and mid-career HR professionals who wanted to advance their career and want to come, you know, to the campus program here at Villanova and pursue it. So a real mixture on campus, but in terms of past HR experience. As I said, with some changes we've made, so we're dropping our experience requirement in the online space, and we're hoping that you know, we can pick up some people who want to make, who we've previously said no to, want to get into HR.
And for those that already have experience and are currently working in the field when they enter the program, or are they primarily looking to just further their professional development in order to become a better HR professional, or are majority of them looking to advance in their career and it's a requirement for them to have this graduate degree to be able to take on some of the leadership positions?
I think you get a mixture from our students in terms of what are their motivations. And sometimes they can be, you know, someone who has multiple things that kind of explain why they want to get this advanced degree. So I think you're hitting the big ones. Someone wants to advance their career, having a master's degree in HR signals that, along with maybe getting a certification from SHRM or from HRCI if they want to get the PHR or SPHR designation. You have some people who do it because it's just a personal achievement. They want to have a master's degree, and that's something that's always been important to them, and the pursuit of that. I don't know how many it becomes a requirement of the job. It may be a job that they're pursuing that that they know that they need to position themselves so that they can be competitive when a vacancy opens, or perhaps, you know, they're not seeing a career that goes where they want it to go in their organization. So they need to get a credential to be able to pursue something perhaps with another organization. Now, another reason I think that people come to our program is that we have such a strong network of alumni who've come through. And the connections, I think we all know that, you know, the networking and connections make a difference in a career. And the Villanova network is very strong in the Philadelphia region. And Villanova, they stay in touch with one another. When they're looking for a job, they're reaching out and looking for opportunities from among that network. And when they have an opening, people come back to that network and look for people. So, that, you know, there's great value in being associated with our program. I'm sure that's true of other programs as well, but we kind of stand out in the Philadelphia area because of our long history of being here and the number of people out there. You go to an HR chapter, SHRM chapter meeting, you could ask a question, how many people have a connection? They'll know, you will find, you know, lots of people there who have some connection back to our program.
So now let's really dig deep into the actual curriculum set. Because being in the HR space, I know that the industry is moving at like a head spinning pace. So when it comes to really optimizing the curriculum to make sure that you're teaching current trends and making sure that you're not preparing the students not only for today, but tomorrow, let's go backwards and then go forward. So over the past 3 years or 5 years, what have been some of the areas that your department was not really focusing on, but it was a huge demand in the industry for the students to know once they got into the workforce? And how did you rapidly include that into your curriculum?
I think there were three things that stuck out in our analysis. And, you know, the good news was when we did the analysis, it wasn't like we had found that there were, you know, all these enormous gaps. Most of the course titles, some of them I think we just wanted to update because the terminology had changed. So our class called financial management is now called financial and human capital. So we're recognizing, trying to bring more HR into that. But the good news was that the course placeholders didn't radically change. And we have gone through and we have a process for updating all of our courses. So no matter what area you're talking about, we have people who are able to scan and know what's going on so that we can build that into the curriculum. And then an ongoing process to make adjustments as developments happen all the time. 6 months from now, we could be looking at one of our courses and say, hey, we need to bring this into the classroom. But the three areas I think that we discovered, one was global. I'm going to throw the terms out there. Global. Another was technology. And a third was analytics. So those are the three areas where I think there's been a lot of progress, a lot of change, disruption, to use a current word. And we needed to reflect that in our class. We always had classes on diversity and inclusion. We now recognize that the world is flat, getting smaller, more connected. So we've got to build some international and global perspectives into our HR curriculum. Technology is advancing, and its impact on HR, I think, is going to be, as you know, because it's an area that I think you spend some time on, that is a huge place where HR needs to make adjustments. And the third is sort of related to the technology, is this notion of analytics. Previously, we had a class called Metrics, HR Metrics, and the title has transitioned to HR Analytics, and the volume of data, the big data, the kinds of information we can collect as HR inside organizations is just exponentially increasing, and what we can do with it. We need people who know how to work with that quantitative information, or at least be able to interpret it if they're not necessarily a numbers person. So those are the three areas that I think we found.
That's awesome. And I would really like to dig into each of those individually. So let's start with global. What is a student learning in regards to thinking global, managing a global workforce? Or let's just talk about, what does that mean when you say that a student is learning to work in HR in a global perspective?
So we have two classes that we've created. One of them had roots. It was something, I believe it was called Diversity in a Global Economy, but we're pushing it to emphasize more the global nature of it, the fact that organizations benefit from this diversity. So and that still has more of a domestic perspective to it as we have this multicultural society. The one class that is more directed at the international HR, if you're working for a multinational organization and you have to deal with expatriates or other issues associated with staffing all around the world, is called Strategic and Global HR Leadership. And we have faculty who work and have proficiency in international HR issues who are designing that class. And so, that's kind of our approach to the international issues. We recognize that a lot of HR, kind of day-to-day HR for many HR professionals is not global or international. So, I would not sell our program as we're an international HR program, but we want to give that opportunity for the students who are seeking that expertise or background, and at the same time, getting the HR generalist perspective.
Okay. And let's do the same thing for technology. How are students really learning and understanding HR technology?
So we have a class on a technology called Human Resource Technology Solutions, and the faculty that we get there, are faculty who work. We're right nearby SAP. We have one of our faculty members, actually a couple, who are employed at SAP and are able to bring their experience in working with technology into the both the course design as well as the teaching on that. So we know that you know, the human resource information systems and what information we can pull together, it's largely untapped, I think, in many ways. And the trick is, how do you bring some, you know, turn data into meaningful information that can inform decisions and help organizations be more effective? So it's not just the nuts and bolts of, you know, technology, but asking some of the strategic questions that I think are, you know, important for HR professionals and adding value to their organization.
And you just touched on it a little bit with the previous answer, but what's near and dear to my heart, HR analytics. How are students learning about this and how to leverage it?
One of the things that is important aspect of the Villanova HRD program, and something that was important to me coming from the background that I had, IO psychologists adopt something called a science practitioner model, because we're psychologists, but we're working in the field of psychology where our subject matter of interest is organizations, people at the worksite. Psychology has a very strong interest in good experimental design, using the scientific method. And so we have to figure out how, as IO psychologists, we bring that expertise to kind of a messy world, but we also make sure that we're striking the right balance and tension between the science and the practice. And I think that's where HR analytics comes in. There's all these quantitative information, and you can apply the perspective or the framework of research methodology and use the statistical tools to bring some understanding, looking for patterns that can help organizations function. And with, you know, the proliferation in smartphones, in, you know, all of the information that can be collected, that if you look back 15, 20 years was, you know, just non-existent, there's so much potential for data. Of course, you've got privacy concerns, and, you know, that's another whole area we can talk about. But from an analytics perspective, if you're just interested in, you know, having data available to you, far more available today than it's ever been, but you can get lost in that data if you don't have the techniques for examining that data and also understanding the authenticity of it, the relevance of it, and the ability not to have see something that's not really there because, you know, of statistical probabilities and so on. So we think that's important background for our students to have. We've created four certificate programs. So while we're a generalist program, while you're getting your master's degree without actually having to take extra credits, you can earn a certificate in an area of specialization. And one of them is called HR Analytics and Research. And this is intended for people who really want to get, you know, deep into the methodology and into the analytics and, you know, go work in that area. So in addition to the HR analytics class, we have a class in quantitative and qualitative research methods. In fact, that's a 6-credit class. So it's a double class, along with technology and organization development. So those are the requirements for students who want to specialize in the HR analytics.
So we just spoke about the gaps that you and your department felt as though you needed to fill from areas that were cropping up in importance over the past few years. But now when we look forward, what areas do you think are extremely important and really hot topic trends that people need to learn? And I'm going to say it's interesting because some of the things that all programs and universities that were focusing on HR were focusing on previously are things that are popping back up now, like diversity, gender wage gap, harassment, and employee relations. These are really important things that are going on now. So are you more so looking at what are the trends in the media and the news and pop culture that are happening and how that could affect HR? Or are you more so looking at how things are changing in the workplace? And are they the same or are they different?
That's a deep question. Multiple questions there. Let me tackle it a couple different ways. As you were asking, I was thinking old wine and new skins. Things do get recycled because people are people. And I think that's an important, we're based in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences and in the psychology department, and we like our home. And it's a little different than a lot of other programs that are housed in business schools or placed somewhere else. HR really has much of its functions, much of its professional expertise in terms of a knowledge in psychology and management. So in that research literature as to what's going on. So when I say, people are people, and even as the world changes, I think there are some fundamental things about people and what motivates them, what needs do they have. I mean, think of Maslow's hierarchy, argue about whether, there's a strong research, but I think there's a conceptual appeal to it that people have needs. And let's take a look at the gig economy. There's a perfect example of how the world has changed that impacts something very important in Maslow's hierarchy, which is security needs. You hear about, if you're hopping from job to job and you don't have what we had traditionally in terms of the social contract between workers and businesses and their employer, you have much more vulnerability to things like medical benefits or other, retirement, building up a retirement. You don't have those options in this emerging new gig economy. And I think that's an issue, we at Villanova can't solve. We can think about it. We can talk about it. That's a policy issue for society is how can we structure ourselves so that, we can support these new versions of things in the economy. So we have to pay attention to those types of things. One of the things that we do in our program is we offer 1.5 credit classes. And many times these are classes that where there's something happening and students want to know about it. It hasn't, made its way into a textbook yet, let's say. And we're not even sure, whether it's going to go. Is it a fad, the next shiny object that we're looking at? And then there'll be something else that'll take our attention away. But if it seems like it might be going someplace, we might offer a class on it. So, for example, we have a 1.5 credit class on social and emotional intelligence. There is, an opportunity to come in and learn something about a concept that starts to get some currency within organizations and an opportunity to, take a look at it. Let's look at the science behind it. Let's look at the practice behind it. Is there something there? So there's an example. And I have one other thing. I would see, you asked, where do I see things going? I think that something I'm interested in trying to infuse more, not only into our program and training, but I think it's going to happen to HR like it happened in the field of medicine. And that is something called evidence-based practice. And there's the Center for Evidence-Based Management, actually housed in Amsterdam, but they have affiliations with Carnegie Mellon here, in the state of Pennsylvania, across the state from where we are, and NYU connections out with some professors at Stanford. And they're actually talking to SHRM about how the profession can move in this same direction that medicine did, which is that when problems and issues come up inside organizations and people turn to HR, that the HR professional thinks about what do we know about this? What does science tell? What's the best available evidence for looking at this issue? And we want to train our students in evidence-based HR practice. So I think that's going to be something where the profession's moving and we'll be well positioned to have our students ready for that.
So is evidence-based HR data-driven HR, or are those two different things?
I think it's not only data-driven, it's being able to look at the quality of the data, because not all data is created equal, and what conclusions you can draw from it. So I think it's a very sophisticated data-driven HR, but not exclusively. I mean, evidence is can take lots of different forms, including professional judgment and expertise. But professional judgment and expertise shouldn't trump a meta-analysis that has 100 different studies. You know, if someone on their professional judgment wants to go at odds against a meta-analysis that is well done, sophisticated, then I would question their ability, their critical thinking abilities. You're bypassing some very strong and quality evidence in exchange for something that's, you know, and perhaps more individualized and arrived at, you know, through that individual experience. Now, individual experience has a lot of value when, in combination with, you know, the research evidence that's there, or if we really don't have better evidence, then that's where we should look. But if we have better evidence, we should go where the quality of the evidence takes us.
Interesting. And before we go into what type of people should go into HR, you just spoke about a class around, I believe, emotional intelligence.
Yes.
So I would love to know exactly what type of classes do you have, and what are you helping to teach around emotional intelligence and burnout? Because I've spoken to a lot of HR professionals who are taking a lot of emotional baggage home. Not only are they thinking about the data-driven side, the performance side, to make sure that people are doing their job well and that they're hiring appropriately and correctly and for the right fit, and doing all these things that are very data-driven or operational-driven, but then there's a whole emotional side too, with benefits and compensation and employee relations. So what are you teaching around that to make sure that they know what they're getting into, but then they also can actually survive in this environment?
I think that's a side of HR that it's important for people going into this field to recognize, and kind of personalize this, and then I can maybe step in back and answer just in terms of the program. Because I want to talk about my transition into HR, where, you know, I worked in research and I did surveys and analyzed data, put presentations together. And that was my job for 9 years. I, you know, could walk into a room, make sure I was able to try to translate my findings, get people's attention, do good data analysis, figure out, you know, how I could be. And then all of a sudden I was HR manager. Not all of a sudden, I mean, but it was a huge career shift for me. When I got the job, the promotion, and I walked into a room where, the day before I was assistant director of research, and now I'm assistant executive director for human resources, the room would stop talking. They recognized I was not in research anymore. I'm in HR. So you're kind of like, you know, internal affairs for a police department. No one wants to talk, oh, HR is here. And then that's just a little flavor of, you know, what this transition is like and how people view you and perhaps treat you. And of course, it's going to depend on the organization and the culture of the organization. One of the things that happened to me, there have been lots of difficult conversations occur in HR. And when I, as HR manager, two things that kind of stick out to me was I needed to keep a Kleenex box in my office at all times. And my wife told me I need to put a mirror up because I would come home and tell her that, you know, I had someone cry in my office today.
Wow.
And she said, well, you know, if it's a woman, she doesn't want to go back out without checking to see what her eyes look like. And I hadn't even thought of that. So I put a mirror up, and, you know, so you're there if it's a shoulder to cry on, or, you know, people are, so there is this emotional side to it. And So I think that the answer is that much of this is learned through experience. When I was as a relatively new HR manager, I had someone who was working for me half time in my department and half time in another department, and we needed the support in HR. But the department where she was working the other half time didn't want to give her up, and I knew what I needed as a department and what the organization needed, and that was for this to become a full time position in HR. But the supervisor in this other department was giving me a really hard time. And I went to my executive director and I was kind of whining about it, saying, concerned about upsetting this other supervisor. And she looked at me and she told me quite bluntly, if you can't handle the emotional fallout, then don't do it. And that just hit me so hard. It was like, oh, she's right. I have to kind of grow into this position and realize you're not going to make everybody happy. Now, you can't become so calloused that you're not compassionate and empathic, because I think that's so important to being a good HR professional. But you can't be so thin-skinned that you can't do what's right for the organization. And that's a learning experience. I'm not sure you can teach that. It's something you have to go through and figure out how maybe look for support systems. So the soft skills are ones that many business majors decide, these are the fluff courses, but it turns out that the soft skills, which are taught in psychology, understanding people, which I think you're referring to on the emotional side of HR, they're the ones that can make or break a career. If they're absent, you're not going to go as far as you might aspire. And if you possess them, they're going to accentuate all the other positives that you have. Now, the people we're reading a lot about in the news are ones that are missing some of this, empathy and compassion, and perhaps what we mean by emotional and social intelligence.
That was great. And your wife, she definitely gave you some gems. She gave you a key to help you make you a successful HR person. So kudos to her. So this is a great transition to speak about what kind of people should go into HR and who will be successful. I saw a video online with you talking about HR and what type of people should go into the space. And you said that you believe the three key traits of a successful HR professional should be personal credibility, authenticity, and being principled. So I wanted to get your thoughts and to dig a little deeper on all three of those things.
Okay. So what was my number one?
Personal credibility.
Personal credibility. So Germ talks about the aspects of HR, sort of roles that HR plays. And personal credibility is one that they call credible. I would say that translates to what they call credible activists. And I think that, there's a lot of confidential, sensitive information. Employees need to know that if they come to you to the degree that you can, that you're going to maintain that confidentiality, that they can trust you, that when you have an issue or there's a concern, that you're going to be conscientious about it. There's going to be a due diligence about how it's going to be handled. And that all goes to this notion of personal credibility as well, that you have a responsibility to advocate, protect employee interests at the same time that you're trying to help the organization and make sure that it's safe from perhaps legal vulnerability or damage, or how it's operating from an effectiveness perspective. I think a lot of these stories about that are coming out in the Me Too movement show that HR has kind of missed what's going on in the organization. And I think it's a kind of an important reflection time to try to look at You know, why is that? Why wasn't HR there to be the place that people felt comfortable coming? And, you know, did they tilt more towards the organization and employees didn't feel like they could come in and bring a legitimate concern that they had? So I think in general, you know, personal credibility is an important aspect of, you know, think about, can you trust this person? If you can't, do you really want them doing HR?
The next was authenticity.
Yeah, I think that maybe it's related to, you know, the credibility, that if you feel like someone is not giving you the straight answer on maybe why they didn't get the job, or giving them feedback from a performance perspective, or if you're talking to a manager who has a problem with an employee, they need to know that there's a genuineness behind, you know, what that interaction with you is. So quite frankly, not being authentic can really tax you. I mean, if you can't be in an HR position and be authentic, and you know, some of that is back to maybe some emotional control, which is maybe not as authentic, but so being maybe too authentic can sometimes work against you. But that's not the side of authenticity that I'm talking about. It's more that, you know, you're not telling two different stories, you're not being two-faced about issues, and that you're being direct and honest.
And lastly, being principled.
So the principled side of this, maybe the, you know, authenticity and principled are part of this personal credibility as I think about it. So being principled is that, you know, there isn't this moral compass that is untethered, that lots of, and I can think back to, you know, experiences that I've had where you're sitting as a member of the management team and you're talking about something, and I think you need to talk about things. You know, you can't squelch ideas, but you have to be able to be the person who says, is this the right thing to do? Let's look at our values here. Now, how does this square with what we say? So, you know, we talk about values in use versus values that we advertise, and we want those things to be the same. And so in those teams that you're working, you know, being principled means that you have to be willing to speak up despite the pressure that you might be feeling for why in the moment you want to do X or Y, but you said, you know, Z is what's important to you. So I think that's an important component to being successful in HR.
So in regards to our topic of preparing the HR leaders of tomorrow, how do you think companies today feel that HR students and aspiring HR leaders are actually prepared to work in their environment? Do you think that there's a huge gap between where students think they are versus where companies want them to be? Or does it seem from your experience that students are pretty on par where what the companies will expect for them to have as a knowledge base and experience level to do the job?
Well, I think in broad brush strokes, what we've seen is, you know, looking back 20, 25 years, that we've seen this transition from HR being an administrative unit called personnel, very compliance oriented and not operating, you know, inside the organization at a strategic level. And I think organizations responded by putting people into those positions. I mean, I'm stereotyping here, broad brush, though it's certainly not true in every case. And I think organizations that didn't do that probably were ahead of the curve and benefited from it. But we've seen this transition. So they put people in there, they were sort of consistent with the function that they'd outlined for HR. We've seen the profession advance. It's maturing, and I think that organizations are increasingly seeking well-trained HR professionals. So you have this notion of it's important that someone have what I was just talking about, these personal credibility issues, the authenticity and being principled and so on. But we also have to match that with competencies within HR. But even that's not enough. So being steeped in HR. So if I took, you know, my knowledge of all the areas of HR and went into an organization, and I might be able to be helpful, but not until I understand their business. And that's the third piece of this is I think HR professionals need to understand the organization, its industry that organization is in. Here's a story. I hired, when I had a vacancy in HR where I worked, I was interviewing someone. She was someone who previously worked at a warehouse. And I was reading her resume, and on her resume, it said that she was a certified forklift operator. So I said to her, tell me about this certification. You are working in HR and you're a certified forklift operator. She said, in order for me to have the credibility and acceptance, I went out and got trained and certified as a forklift operator because that's who I was working with. That's who I was hiring. And So, you know, that's, I think, is an example of how someone in HR can convey an affinity for and an understanding of the business that they're in. So they're bringing their HR knowledge and expertise, but they're also translating it and understanding, you know, what are we about? Got to make cross that bridge.
I was listening to a talk the other day, and it was someone from the HR space speaking to a lot of HR professionals, saying that a lot of their leadership roles were being taken away from people outside of HR because CEOs didn't believe that their current HR staff really had what it takes to manage the team from a business perspective. So how do you feel about that? What are you seeing in regards to a lot of the CHROs, VP of people, C-level or executive level HR positions coming, being filled with non-traditional HR roles or people who don't have HR experience? And then how is your department helping a lot of HR professionals really understand, just like what you said, not only about their business, but business in general?
So I think that what that is symptomatic of this gap. You want people who understand HR and you want people to understand the business. So there's a couple ways to solve that. One is send non-HR people into HR. They understand the business and they'll learn HR. That's the theory, I think, behind it. And the other is to send HR people out into the business. So we have, HR business partners. So we embed them in field office locations and try to close that gap in that way. But I do think it goes back to HR professionals taking responsibility for all of the elements that I think are necessary for being successful. So yes, you've got personal credibility and you've got HR mastery, but you also have this need to understand the business. And I guess the other thing I'd say, and I've thought a lot about, and Peter Capelli has written about it, and from Wharton, and that is, and I sort of said this earlier when I told the story about walking into the room and everybody being quiet, HR's here. If you're going to be strategic and fulfill a strategic role for the organization, that can't be the relationship that you have with the people in your organization, that they view you as internal affairs, that you're the cops who are there to catch them doing something wrong, or if there's, that they can't speak freely. I think that comes from HR having responsibility for the compliance side of organizational operations, and so there's a debate going on as to whether or not it's possible to be both responsible for compliance and be able to deliver strategic value to the organization. And maybe the answer is you can't, and they've got to be separated in some way, I think that some of what the CEOs are experiencing are people who are conflicted by the two objectives that they've been given, which is keep the organization out of legal trouble and make sure they're compliant, and at the same time, push the envelope as to where we need to go. That can be a difficult balancing act.
That was great. And then last question before we go into our lightning round, what's one thing or just a few things that you want to leave with any aspiring HR professional who wants to get into the space, or any current HR professional who's looking to further their studies or further their professional development in this space? Any parting words of wisdom?
I think that kind of touched on the demands on HR professionals, responsibility for the organization, responsibility for people, and trying to find that balance. In our strategic review that we engaged in, we developed a vision statement for our program. A vision statement, as you probably are aware, is not something that you can check off that this is what we're doing, but it's more aspirational. It's where we see where we want to go, where we're going to try and drive the program. We're going to check on it when we're, you know, every time there's something consequential that we're decision we're making about the program. Is this moving us towards our vision? Can it move us towards our vision? So our vision for our program was to say, very briefly, we develop global thought leaders in HR who drive high-performing, inclusive organizations and create meaningful work experiences. Each of those words, I mean, this isn't something that we just jotted out in 5 minutes. It was debated over a series of meetings until we kind of packed it full of things that we thought were so important. So, you know, the notion of global, we're recognizing that the world is getting smaller, as I said. So if you're an HR professional, I think you got to recognize that that's where you're going to be asked to operate. Thought leaders refers to, you know, we don't want this to be a passive reactive profession. We want to drive the conversation. We want to see where we can find and add value to the organization. High performing, driving high performing, inclusive organizations. So we're recognizing that organizations have to be successful or, you know, it's going, not going to exist. At the same time, we can't leave people behind. So, and in fact, it is a necessary ingredient for the organization to be high performing, and that is to be inclusive. And then finally, to say create meaningful work experiences. I think we have to recognize our responsibility, our opportunity to help in our society. People spend so much time working, and I think that work should be something that is meaningful, and HR can help that. And by helping make that happen, they also accomplish things for their organization if they take the long view on it. So I don't know if that was a direct answer.
No, that was great. That was great. And I hope everyone who's looking to go into HR really took a lot of notes, because that was amazing. So now we're going to go into a very quick lightning round section, what I like to call the real, the random, and ridiculous, where I ask you a real, a random, and ridiculous question. So the real question, do you like bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made?
I don't have a lot of experience. I probably would never order it. The one time I recall having it was I was at dinner, and it was one of the dessert offerings. It was one of these, everyone was passing desserts. And I was surprised at how much I like bread pudding. And why I wondered why I hadn't ordered it. So I don't have a lot of experience, so I can't answer that. How do I like it prepared? But I know the one time I did have it, I was surprised at how good it was.
That's the right answer. That's the only answer, that it's great. And we'll have to meet. I'll have to bring you some bread pudding. So the random question, if you could have one superpower, what would it be and why?
Oh, boy. My superpower would be to achieve the right balance between, you know, all of the things that are important about life. In fact, I have a book on my shelf called The Way We're Working Isn't Working. And it's a very, it's talking about evidence-based, very research-based approach to how you're living your life. And it divides it up into, you know, spiritual, emotional, physical, intellectual. And it seems to be a lifelong pursuit of mine is to try to keep things in balance. And it always seems to get out of kilter. I'm working too much and I don't get my exercise. So living a balanced life to me would be a superpower.
Okay. And last question of this round, the ridiculous question. What's the most ridiculous perception you think people have about HR?
That only people, persons go into it. I think, or that you have to be a people person, whatever that means. I think that undercuts HR. I think that, yeah, you have to have interpersonal skills and communication skills, but it's not a requirement. And in fact, talk about keeping things in balance. It can make it difficult to do other aspects of the profession. So I don't know. I wasn't prepared for this. That's what popped into my head. So
No, we want the real answer that comes to the top of your head. Well, that was great. So last and final question of the interview, favorite and least favorite part of HR?
My favorite part, when I, as a manager of HR, was when I got feedback about somebody who I was instrumental in hiring. It always made me feel good. And you always have this connection to the people that you were involved in their selection process. And when someone would come to me, a manager would come to me and say, hey, Dan is doing these unbelievable things, especially if it was a challenge to kind of get it through our, you know, an approval process. And the least favorite part, I would say, was in the selection process. I really did not like me. We tried to, many of our positions, be kind of high touch with the applicants and telling applicants who'd come in for an interview that they didn't get the job. So you had one fun phone call and maybe six or seven unpleasant calls. And it really depended on who it was you were talking to. So, you know, and if there were internal candidates, it made it even tougher to have those conversations. But they were worth it because I think even if people didn't like the answer, they appreciated that you did it. But that's not a fun part of HR.
Nice. Well, Jerry, this has been an amazing episode. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio.
Woo! Thanks for inviting us.
This is great. We really wanted to have someone that could speak fluently and intelligently about how to prepare aspiring HR leaders, and coming from your department and being in a position where you are teaching the leaders of tomorrow is great. So thank you very much. Where can people find you and your department online?
So anyone who finds things I've said as interesting or want to talk further about the program, we have a website right on the Villanova website. Search for graduate programs in human resource development. You'll see our vision statement that I was talking about that'll pop right up there, but lots of information about it. Villanova also has open houses. You can contact me or others through the emails that are available there. We're happy to talk to you, answer any questions, and get to know you. If this is I always tell people I'm not selling this program. I don't think I have to sell it. What I really am interested in is finding, you know, the match. If this is what you're looking for, I think we've got a great, great program, but if you want to do something else, I'm not going to talk you into this. This works if it's right for you.
And for those HR professionals out there who may be interested in becoming an adjunct professor, is your department hiring?
We have a sort of an open advertisement for adjunct, and it goes through the apply for a job at Villanova. So you can send your information. We're always interested in collecting that. With all the transitions, I think the high watermark for our campus program was around 100 or 100 plus students. We're around 50 right now. We're building it back up. We've had a good enrollment. So we're targeting getting back to the 80 to 100. And as we do, our needs for adjunct will present themselves. Same true on our online space. If that's something. So our online program has a virtual classroom that takes place every week for 2 hours. So if you're teaching online, you're teaching from 8:30 to 10:30 at night, because we've got people on the West Coast who want to be in the classroom, which is always interesting, the diversity that we get in those classrooms. So send it in. We'd love to hear from you. I'm expecting that we're going to need more people for both attrition reasons as well as growth.
Well, that's great. And we'll definitely put all that information and links in the show notes. Well, folks, thanks again for listening to this awesome podcast episode. I hope you learned a lot, took a lot of notes, and got a lot out of it. If you really enjoyed this conversation, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. If you're listening to this from the website and not from your favorite podcast player, please download us in your podcast player. And for those data-driven HR professionals out there, if you are looking for a standalone HR dashboard to be able to track all your most important and relevant metrics, please go to employeecycle.com and sign up for a demo today. HR folks out there, please continue to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Thanks. Later, kids.